from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The history of Native America is widely seen as one of tragedy and betrayal, massacres of tribes, the Trail of Tears, forced assimilation in boarding schools and family separations, poverty. Anthropologist David Troyer does not deny the hardships and losses Native Americans have endured, but that is not the story he wants to tell. In his new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present, Troyer focuses on the resilience of the Indian people who continue to respond to loss with ingenuity and conviction. David Troyer, welcome to Forum.
Although I would dispute being called an anthropologist, although I studied it as an undergraduate and a graduate student. I've never been an anthropologist. I've never taught it. I've never published anthropology. It's in my past.
Well, that is good to know. We have you down as an English professor at the University of Southern California as well.
Correct.
Would that be a much more apt description?
Yeah.
And actually, I think we may have overlapped at the University of Michigan. I was there as an undergrad from 94 to 97. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We were there at the same time.
Yeah.
So we go way back.
And I understand at that time, or maybe you were doing some studying of anthropology, but you are the author, as I said, of the book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, which, of course, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee is a reference to the famous 1970 work by Dee Brown, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, about the massacre of Lakota Sioux at the hands of the U.S. in 1890. Can you talk about what your book is referencing here and what your relationship was to Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee?
Sure. So when I read Dee Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and I was far away from home, and I wanted to grab on to something that was mine, that was ours, I read his book, and he says in the very opening pages that he's focusing on the Plains Wars, and he starts in 1850, and he ends in 1890 at the massacre at Wounded Knee, where, quote, the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed, end quote. And he goes on to say in the prologue, that if you happen to travel to a contemporary Indian reservation and see the hopelessness and poverty and squalor, perhaps by reading my book, you will understand why. And so I felt a lot of conflicting emotions. On one hand, I was glad that he was bringing his expertise and sensitivity to bear on history that concerned us. And on the other hand, I felt completely isolated and almost killed all over again because there he was, you know, stating in what was to become the best-selling book of American Indian history ever published, that we were dead and gone. And I certainly wasn't dead and gone, and neither was my tribe and my community.
And how do you think this view pervades people's general engagement or interaction or understanding with Native Americans, of Native Americans?
Oh, it pervades sort of, you know, pretty much every narrative that is told about us. I mean, as you mentioned in your intro, the dominant narrative that's used to describe or tell stories of Indian lives is tragedy. Our stories are told in the tragic mode. Which has a couple of pernicious effects. On one hand, history is something that did us in, and we're not really perceived as being historical actors or having any kind of real power. And on the other, it renders our continued existence as a non-existence. That essentially we died in 1890, and if we're not dead, we've just been living some sort of, you know, afterlife of constant suffering. And I think this sort of not only gets us wrong, but it gets the country wrong. It gets America and its history more broadly wrong.
And what effect do you think it has on Indians themselves? We've talked a little bit about how other people then sort of mistakenly perceive Native Americans, but then how about within the community? Do you think it has an effect there?
Sure. I think, you know, it's affected our own self-regard. And just speaking personally, I drank that Kool-Aid for many years. You know, I kind of thought of myself as belonging to a once great people who are great no more. And if I feel that way, and if my fellow Native folk feel that way, how we tell the story of our past will shape the possible future. And so if we tell a story of our diminishment and demise, then I don't know what kind of future we could possibly have. And so it's important to imagine the past differently, to use different narratives to tell our story in order to make real a better future.
Well, one of the ways that you do this that I was struck by was when you were talking about boarding schools, that terrible time in the late 1870s to the late 1930s, when Native American children were separated from their families and forced to assimilate at these very restrictive and in some cases horrific boarding schools. Can you talk about that and what happened to children, but then also how you see this as an example of resilience?
Right. So it would be so easy to think about residential boarding schools in that period in our history of abuse and forced assimilation and cultural loss as tragic. And it certainly was painful. Even in my own family, my grandmother was taken from her mother when she was 4 years old and didn't return until she was 10. And that affected her relationship with her mother to such an extent that when she returned home, she didn't feel happy, she didn't feel sad, she didn't feel anything. And so in order to simulate joy, she poked her own eyeballs with her fingers to make it seem as though she were crying. Because she didn't feel anything, and she knew she was supposed to. And that affected, of course, how she parented my mother, which affected, of course, how my mother parented me. So it would be easy to just focus on the pain and the agony of that experience. And there's good reason to. But on the other hand, there were other unintended consequences of boarding schools. And if we change the narrative, we can change our vision. So, for instance, you know, these boarding schools collected Native kids from tribes that were spread across the country and jammed them all together. And so tribes that were unknown to one another or even antagonistic and had an antagonistic relationship, you know, dating back many centuries, all of a sudden these kids were in the same boat, experiencing the same things, experiencing the same losses. And so after they graduated from these schools and went back to their lives on reservations and tribal communities across the country, they moved forth into adulthood with a network of relationships with people they never would have had relationships with before, professional relationships, friendships, romantic relationships. And that created a kind of unintended pan-tribal, transnational coalition of Native people who drew on each other's strengths to see tribal communities into the middle part of the 20th century.
And do you think that that helped with connections when American Indians were relocated, when they moved into cities as well, these networks?
Absolutely. Yeah, because it wasn't just boarding schools. I mean, boarding schools were followed by tribal self-determination, which was followed by termination and relocation. So when the Native American diaspora sort of really began in the 1940s with Native folk moving off reservations to border towns, to suburbs, to inner cities, they brought this sense of intertribalism with them and helped them as they moved out and into sort of broader America.
We're talking with David Troyer about his new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. Troyer is an Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. And we're talking about his approach to writing this history in terms of looking at the experiences of Indigenous people as something very much showing ingenuity, resilience, conviction, and livelihood. David Troyer, we're in the Bay Area, and I was wondering if you could comment on what role you feel like the occupation of Alcatraz played, how you would like people to understand that occupation in Native American history.
Right. Well, I mean, the occupation of Alcatraz in the late 60s and early 70s, I believe, was a profound turning point in the relationship between American Indians and Americans more generally. So for many centuries, Native Americans, we've occupied huge parts of the imagination and we're fundamental to the myths that America tells about itself. From the Boston Tea Party, where the colonists dressed up as Indians to dump tea in Boston Harbor, to myths and ideas about the frontier, we are central to America's self-regard. On the other hand, we're largely absent from the daily lives of most Americans. Most Americans will go through their lives without having any meaningful, sustained interactions with us. So that puts us in the position of being the most visible, invisible minority in the country. And so beginning in the 60s and beginning in the Bay at Alcatraz and on Alcatraz Island, American Indians understood this really well. American Indian activists used, you know, places like Alcatraz and engaged in these very symbolic takeovers of public spaces as a way to draw America's gaze to our continued lived existence and to extract from America a different disposition and a different set of promises in the form of legislation and funding and all sorts of other things. And they had to do this. We didn't have force of numbers at that time, but we did have force of image. And the Red Power movement and the early activists at Alcatraz were some of the first to really draw the nation's gaze to us and to our contemporary existence. And for that, they can't be thanked enough.
The Red Power movement is different from the American Indian movement, right? They're a separate entity?
Yes. Yeah, what, they're separate.
What is your assessment of the legacy of the American Indian movement?
The American Indian movement, it's complicated. They subsequent to Alcatraz, engaged in their own brand of takeovers of the Wounded Knee Training Post in Wounded Knee, South Dakota, of buildings in Custer, South Dakota, of Nike, a naval base near Chicago, the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. They also engaged in these high-profile symbolic takeovers and marches and sit-ins and so on, with a decidedly more militant and violent aspect. And so on one hand, I think a lot of the actions of the leadership of the American Indian movement were in many ways destructive. They couldn't imagine anything other than a violent confrontation, so they got engaged in violent confrontations they ultimately could not win. On the other hand, the rank and file of the American Indian movement, sort of citizens from communities on reservations but largely in cities across the country, did built things that the leadership itself didn't build. Community programs, community schools, neighborhood watches, health clinics. It is kind of like the Black Panthers. We focus on some of the more extreme actions of the leadership of the Black Panthers, but the Black Panther Party also in the Bay Area did things like, you know, set up health clinics and schools and worked on literacy and vaccinations and all sorts of really important things for the health and well-being of the African-American community in the Bay Area. And the American Indian movement is very similar to that. So you have to make a distinction between leadership and rank and file if you want to think about the legacy of both organizations.
Have you got some pushback from your book? From how you discuss certain leaders in the American Indian movement, or even just this approach that you're taking where you are trying to focus on the strengths of the community as opposed to some really atrocious treatment.
There's been no pushback yet. The book is a brand new bouncing baby book. It just launched on Tuesday. But I anticipate there'll be a range of reactions to it. And in any kind of healthy debate, I would expect that. And I would hope for a range of reactions. And I would hope for real debate and dissent from people who are concerned about, you know, the health and continued vitality of our communities. In the past, I wrote about the American Indian movement in a previous book, and I don't know, I heard some
chatter
and gossip.
People know where you stand now.
I think they know where I stand, and I'm okay with it. I really feel like it's important to tell the truth, and I think it's important to sort of look closely at our past and our present, and to hold our leaders to a very high standard. I hold, you know, elected American government officials to a high standard. I think that it's incumbent upon them to be good. I hold our tribal leaders, elected or otherwise, to an even higher standard, because it's one thing to be screwed over by the American government. It's another thing for us to screw ourselves over, and I don't have any patience for that.
Screwing yourselves over. I wonder how you would characterize the role of casinos in the community, whether or not you feel like they overall have been a benefit?
Well, of the 300-plus federally recognized tribes in the United States, roughly a third of them operate casinos. Of those 100-plus tribes with casinos, only a fraction of them earn any real money. And my response when people ask me, like, how have casinos affected the American Indian community, you know, is just to ask a corresponding question back, which is, how have corporations affected the Anglo community?
Mm-hmm.
How has Apple, you know, how has Google affected the Bay? Well, I don't know. It's probably complicated. How has Uber affected the Bay Area? It's not any one thing. It's a mixed bag. Casinos are no different.
Yes, it's mixed in terms of their benefits. And I agree. It is it is an area that requires nuance. I ask the question, I think, because that's where a lot of people now think of the contemporary Native American, even though, as you point out, a very small number actually have them. But it's right. a stereotype that feels like it's quite powerful, especially here in California.
It's a very powerful stereotype. And, you know, I've said for many years that nothing makes people more uncomfortable than the idea of rich Indians. It's almost as though we are supposed to be poor. We're supposed to be downtrodden. We're supposed to be marginalized. That's our function. That's our social utility, you know, in the American machine. That some Native people in some, you know, limited fashion in isolated places have, you know, used gaming to become fabulously wealthy rubs some people the wrong way.
Yes, and I wanted to actually get to some more contemporary examples as well in terms of just the way you feel like Native Americans are regarded. And, of course, the most recent was the Covington Catholic High School students and that video that went viral of one student in a stare down with a Native American elder. First, what was your reaction to that video?
To the initial one,
yes,
or to the subsequent,
the initial one.
The subsequent, subsequent.
But I'd be curious to know whether the subsequent
screams for context,
yeah. whether the subsequent screams for context changed your mind at all. But what was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction was, you know, same story, different day. I wasn't surprised, you know, to see sort of MAGA hat wearing privileged white kids disrespecting a Native person. Iterations of that have been occurring for centuries. I wasn't surprised in Trump's America to see such bald expressions of privilege flaunted, you know, in the face of people who have, you know, historically been underprivileged. And I was outraged and I was disgusted, not to say that I was surprised, because I wasn't.
You say Trump's America. I wonder if you agree with others' assessments that his mocking of Elizabeth Warren, say, calling her Pocahontas, things like that, if you think that gives people permission to denigrate American Indians even further.
Of course. I don't think we're a special case. You know, I think, you know, Trump's sort of performance of his own crippled spirit, you know, on Twitter and in the office of the presidency every day has an effect on public discourse and public demeanor. You know, the part of our civilization which is civil is quickly leaching out, and he's the whole. So, you know, that gets expressed in relation to Senator Warren is no surprise.
And I don't know if you have already dissected this whole situation where Elizabeth Warren claims Indian ancestry and the questions around bloodlines and identity. Is the fact that she does that bother you at all? What are the ways that this is determined?
You know what bothers me? It are the ways in which people use, you know, sort of this brouhaha over her heritage to avoid the things that she's trying to accomplish in terms of economic and financial reforms. What's interesting about Elizabeth Warren are her economic and financial policies and positions. That's what's interesting about Senator Warren. The fact that she's from Oklahoma and grew up hearing that she was Native to some degree, that she had American Indian heritage, is not surprising, because so many people from Oklahoma grew up hearing that, because Oklahoma is formerly the Indian territories to which many Native folk from across the country were relocated. It is packed with Native people. So that she said that she grew up hearing stories that she was Native, that doesn't surprise me at all. And then she took a DNA test, which proved that that's true. Okay, great. There's no story there. She never claimed that she was a member of a tribal nation or that she should be. She never tried to get any benefit from it. She didn't put it on her application when she applied for the job at Harvard. It was simply in the directory. She's not trying to become an enrolled member of a tribe. She just says, hey, I grew up hearing these stories. What's wrong with that? We all grew up hearing stories. Most of them are true. Some of them aren't. But in her case, it actually is true. So who cares? Let's talk about what's happening with the banks and financial institutions in our country, because they're the ones keeping us all down.
Well, and let's talk about corporations as well. So I want to ask you about Standing Rock and what you feel like the months-long protest against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock, where do you put that in the role and experience of Native Americans today?
Well, you know, the protest at Standing Rock once again got framed as a problem of cowboys versus Indians. That was the language used by David Archambault III, the former tribal chairman of Standing Rock. I don't see that conflict or that protest as a question of cowboys versus Indians or as white people versus Indians.
So you disagree with the Native American leader in the way that he framed it?
I disagree with the rhetoric and the context and the framing. I certainly don't disagree with the protest.
Sure.
The protest itself, to me, the subtext, the real conflict there is between what we value more, corporate interests or the common good. That's the war that's being fought in South Dakota, and that's the war that's being fought over our continued reliance on fossil fuels. It's not cowboys versus Indians, and so I think as a matter of tactics or of optics, if I had been at the protest and I had been one of the water protectors, I might have lobbied for a different narrative that might have, and who knows, maybe not, but might have yielded different results.
Well, speaking of a different narrative, I mean, I feel like there's kind of two, right? There was the success of it in the sense that the Obama administration denied a key permit for the pipeline, but then a few months later, the Trump administration reversed that decision. And so how would you, as someone who is trying to write the narrative in many ways, how would you harness this experience for the good of people?
Well, I mean, on the ground and in terms of that particular pipeline, we could tell the story of a successful protest that was undermined by the election of Trump and which, because of Trump, ultimately failed. You could tell that story. And that might be true, you know, vis-a-vis that particular pipeline in that particular place. But after that protest, after it was all over, those activists have fanned back out into other places and they raised awareness about the continued growth of pipelines across different parts of the country. So, for instance, on my reservation, our tribal government approved a number of pipelines before the Standing Rock protest. After that protest, there is no way in hell anyone could hope to get into office or stay in office on my reservation if they supported pipelines. And so Standing Rock was immensely successful in raising awareness and building strength and building coalitions across the country to stop further development in other places. So seen that way, there was an initial loss, but there's been subsequent success. And I think that's the bigger story.
One of the things that I'm struck by is that you ask Native Americans to stay connected to the past and of course, to acknowledge and understand the tragedies and the atrocities, but at the same time, to focus on the positives, the resiliency, and to play an active role in shaping the future. And I feel like as you're urging others to do that, you've had to go through this process yourself.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how you've, and I don't know if you've reconciled it, but how you do that, how you hold on to both of those things and move forward?
Well, I'm not urging, you know, other Native people to sort of do what I do or say what I say or believe what I believe. I just, I'm urging us to sort of fix what I think of as narrative scarcity, that there are only a few different ways we tell stories about ourselves. And so there's only a few possible outcomes because of that. But in my own life, I mean, it would have been so easy, for instance, when my grandfather, whom I loved, committed suicide at age 83. And I was asked to clean up, you know, the room where he shot himself, and then to write his eulogy. You know, it was a struggle for me then that occurred, you know, maybe about 10 years ago. I can't remember exactly what year now, which is weird. But it would have been easy to see his life as a tragedy with a tragic end. And it took a lot of effort on my part to sort of to try and imagine his life beyond his and apart from his final act. And in that process of trying to understand him, you know, on his own terms, and to leave my grief out of it, I found a way to see him and to remember him and to celebrate him. It was hard fought, that vision of him, and that's the kind of vision I carried forward into this project, which was, it'd be so easy for us, because life gets dark and life does get hard, and we've suffered tremendous losses. It would be so easy to fall back into the comfort of a familiar narrative of victimization. That there's a certain comfort in that. The harder road is to try and imagine different outcomes and different realities, and to see sort of things, not just to see the past the way it really was, but to see the past the way it was in a more complicated fashion in order to make a different future. It's a harder road, maybe. But one thing that I've seen in the years it took me researching and writing this book, one thing I've been confronted with over and over again, is the creativity and intelligence and hard work and texture of Native people. We're not a monolith. You know, we're incredibly diverse, and we have diverse experiences. We come from different tribes. We have different experiences of America, and we've made the country in different ways. And that's something that actually gives me quite a bit of hope. But it was something that I saw over and over again as I was researching the book.
Yes, well, and because your book includes memoir, but also the histories of other people, their stories, I don't know if it was also a process of being able to learn to privilege our own stories as part of making and defining our own history.
Right. That was a really big part of it. I mean, I was very clear with myself that I wanted to write a book about American Indian life, not American Indian death. And to do that, I had to talk to people. I had to listen to people. I had to listen to what they had to say and how and about their lives and how they said it. And I also had to remember, because this ended up being a major point of the book, that we're not simply victims of history. History isn't just a series of events which we've managed to survive. It's something that we've participated in. We've been historical actors as much as we've been victims of circumstance, and that's important to remember.
Well, we're really glad that you did. The book is called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present by David Troyer, an English professor at the University of Southern California. David Troyer, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.